Welcome to The Melodic Line, the official podcast of the George Lloyd Society. My name is Peter Davison, and you've just heard the opening of George Lloyd's Fourth Symphony. We are delighted that for this inaugural programme of the podcast, my guest is none other than William Lloyd, nephew of George and curator of the Composer's Archive and Music Library. Hello and welcome, William.
Hello, Peter, and thank you very much for setting this up. Thank you for inviting me. And I'm quite looking forward to it.
Anyway, today we're going to be discussing George Lloyd's remarkable recovery from the injuries he received while serving in the Royal Marines on board HMS Trinidad during the Second World War. William, I wonder if you can provide a little bit of context here. What was George doing on board HMS Trinidad, and what happened that led to his hospitalisation in 1942?
Well, he was serving on Trinidad as a bandy. A Royal Marine bandsman. He'd wanted to join the Navy when the war started. His family had quite a strong naval tradition. His grandfather had been a Navy commander in the Baltic, and his uncle had served in Jutland, and his brother had joined the Navy. So he wanted to join the Navy, but his eyesight failed him. But then he heard from Rutland Boughton, the composer, who was an admirer of his music, and Rutland Boughton advised him that he may get a place as a bandsman, because there weren't enough ships. There were more volunteers than there were ships in the early days, but not musicians. They were short of musicians. So he joined as a bandsman. He joined HMS Trinidad. She was a new cruiser, and the crew joined the ship while she was being built, and worked on all the systems. And their job was to man the transmitting station for the gunnery, so they would measure the range and elevation and all that. We had very accurate gunners in the Royal Navy, and they were assigned to convoy duty. And in May 1942, Trinidad was guarding a convoy to Murmansk, and a torpedo, one of their own torpedoes, went astray, had a malfunction, and turned round and struck the Trinidad, and 17 men in that compartment were killed. George was the last man out, and he suffered some pretty severe injuries.
And what precisely were those injuries in terms of the physical and mental scars that were left as a consequence?
Well, he was taken to hospital, Royal Naval Hospital near Aberdeen, where they treated some of his physical problems. He'd taken a lot of oil into his lungs, and he'd had an extreme effort of pushing the man in front of him up a ladder with oil coming down in a deluge. He got under his greatcoat and got his shoulder under his backside and managed to push him out and get out himself. So that was an extreme strain, and that he tore lots of muscles, tore various muscles in his body, and so he had physical injuries, and he had a tremendous shake. His limbs were shaking. It wasn't a tremor; it was quite a pronounced shaking of the limbs. He couldn't stand up, he couldn't walk, he couldn't speak. And after his physical injuries were treated a little bit, he was clearly suffering from that what they called then shell shock, what we now call PTSD, which is an extreme psychological breakdown caused by the trauma. And he was discharged from the Royal Navy suffering from shell shock.
And had he lost other colleagues, musical colleagues?
He had. He'd lost... there were 17 men killed in the transmitting station. Nine of them were bandsmen, and they were men that he'd been with for the best part of a year. They played jazz together. They spent all their free time together. They knew each other really well. They were a very, very close-knit band. They were a band. And nine of those men died. And I think that was a big shock.
This was a horrific tragedy on any kind of scale.
It was, and there were all sorts of aspects to it. The fact that it was their own torpedo, the fact that they were drowned in oil, and when the ship was eventually taken into Murmansk and the bodies were recovered, they discovered that the man behind George had been trapped by the hatch, which is a faulty hatch, it turned out. It had shut, the ship went over on its side. Didn't sink, but they got it back to Murmansk. But the ship went over and trapped the next man coming up, who was killed.
And what was the prognosis of the doctors when he got to the naval hospital and had a chance to look at him? What did they feel was the likely outcome?
Well, as George put it, he said they said he was going to be like that for the rest of his life. They didn't give much hope. There were other cases, similar cases, where people had stayed in that pretty traumatic, psychologically damaged state for several years, so there wasn't much hope in that time.
And what happened to him then in terms of
his treatments?
Well, the main thing that happened was his wife Nancy Jouvet, she was Swiss-Irish and quite a formidable woman. She had decided she was going to marry a composer when she was a teenager, and when George came along, having had his great success in London, she decided that he was the man. So they were married very quickly, lightning romance, and she was an extraordinary dynamic and very, very strong woman. She went to visit George in the hospital against his wishes. He didn't want her to see him in that condition, and she decided that there was no future for him in the hospital, but that she might as well have a try. And she persuaded the doctors, basically by badgering them and refusing to go away until they gave in, to release him to her care. And they said, you know, you have to be aware what you're taking on. There's not much chance for this man. But she took him back. She took him first to West Wittering, where there was an aunt who lived there, George's aunt's. And the aunt specialised in looking after damaged servicemen. And they stayed there. And Nancy started a regime of treatment.
At this time, I assume it was generally thought he wasn't going to compose again, and he couldn't compose. I mean, what was the situation with the...
Well, they've never spoke about exactly how they thought, but I know George said he couldn't hold a pen for over a year, and he didn't start writing for a long time. A lot of the first year or two was just getting him to speak, trying to control the shaking, the dreams and nightmares, the horrors of reliving it all, the constant dwelling on what had happened. Those were the things that Nancy had to overcome before he could start again.
But we find that by 1945 he is composing again, and he's made a sufficient recovery to be able to say that the summer of 46 was one of the happiest of his life. So what had happened in those 3 years to turn that all around?
Well, Nancy started up to teach herself psychology and teach herself healing. And I still have a library of books. There's a dozen books, the contemporary books on psychology. Fortunately, Nancy's brother-in-law was a man called George Estabrooks, who's a specialist in the use of hypnosis for treating PTSD, and he helped her. And she read all the psychological books she could find, and she talked to doctors, and she began a program which was mostly diet and exercise, which is very basic stuff, but nevertheless very important, vitamins, but a lot of psychological training, which has now come to be known as cognitive behavioural therapy, which is based on imaging, based on recitation of mantras. She also had quite a strong belief in herbal remedy. She used herbs, she used Bach flower remedies, she used homeopathic remedies, she used all sorts of strange techniques, using pendulum and divination and techniques which are now... So a lot of the techniques are now commonplace, but a lot of them remain, as you might say, paranormal. But one way or another, she helped. They went to Switzerland. As soon as the war was over, they went to Switzerland, and George began to write. He started off by orchestrating the HMS Trinidad March, which he orchestrated for the Swiss Romand Orchestra, and he got started again.
Let's talk a little bit about the Fourth Symphony, which is often referred to as the Arctic. And generally, it's assumed that in some ways it's about his wartime experiences. Do you agree with that? Is that your impression? Did he ever say anything about the symphony as a kind of autobiographical work?
Well, yes and no. In his notes to the symphony, he was quite explicit that there was a connection. I think the phrase used, he was looking back on his time. And I think at that stage, he was clear that he couldn't hide from his illness. He had to face it head on, and he had to banish it from his mind. And one of the ways of banishing it from his mind was through composition. He would work on it and imagine it and turn the negatives into positives. That was the basic principle of what he was doing. And he described some of the colours in the symphony as reminiscent of the colours in the Arctic. I think he said a world of strange storms and peculiar colours, with a lot of darkness and a lot of icy coldness, and some of those feelings he definitely did consciously and deliberately put into the music.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the slow movement, which definitely expresses some of those feelings that you've just described. Thank you. Yes, it's intensely moving and atmospheric, and the work's finale, I think, also expresses a great triumph for the human spirit. Had George completely overcome his PTSD by this time, or was he still suffering symptoms? How long did those symptoms continue after?
Well, he still had the symptoms while he was writing Fourth Symphony and even Fifth Symphony later on when it was a happy piece, but his symptoms lasted way up into the late 1960s. When I was a teenager in the 60s, I stayed with him quite a bit, helped him building greenhouses and odd jobs. And at that point, I was under strict orders from my parents and from Nancy when I got there not to mention his shaking, not to mention his trauma. He would retire into a study and shut the door when he was feeling bad, and he wouldn't talk about it. He wouldn't talk to a journalist because journalists would be apt to spring questions on him, which brought it all back. And Nancy was a bit of a gatekeeper in that respect. So his trauma never really left him all of his life, in that he would, but he could face it. He was no longer completely ruined by it. By the time I started working with him in the 80s, he was more or less over it. And I think by the time he came back, he came back to London in 1970, and at that point he still couldn't talk about it. But by 1980, he'd more or less reconciled. So, well, we're talking 25 years of not being able to really discuss it at all.
And there was this incident in 1982, wasn't there, where there was an unfortunate reminder of that terrible accident at sea in the Regent's Park bombing.
Indeed. Well, he lived in Glentworth Street, which is just round the corner from Regent's Park, and he heard the bomb, and he knew it was a bomb, and he went out, and on his normal walk, every day he walked past the bandstand. Every day, that would be for 15 years, he walked past the bandstand every single day, and on that day there'd been a concert on, the Royal Green Jackets, and there was a bomb, an IRA bomb, under the bandstand, and a lot of men were killed, and that was traumatic because he was one of the early people on the scene. The emergency services hadn't arrived, so there's still the smell of the explosion and body parts and a lot of blood and horrendous scenes.
Yeah, and again, these were musicians. It must have taken him right back to the accident in 1942.
Nancy said he was very traumatised for weeks, but interestingly again, he came out of that trauma with composition because he wrote a piece for brass band. Originally, I think he started to write it for military band, which was the band that was damaged, and it was later adapted for brass band, a piece called In Memoriam. He wrote in order to exorcise the trauma, he wanted to turn it into a piece of music.
William, I know you've told me before that there are some who feel that George's music speaks to the deep psyche and might be described as having its own special healing powers. Do you agree with that? And did George believe that?
I'm not sure that was his intention, but I think he was aware of it, partly because he had a lot of letters, he had post bags full of letters from people who writing to him to say how much their music meant to him, how important it was to them, how it had helped them. And he said in an interview once that he thought people liked his music because they had no spiritual outlet, and because he never abandoned traditional forms of melody and harmony and the big tune, people could engage with his music and it just made them feel better. And he was aware of that. And I had personally a few bits of evidence of the therapeutic effects. On one occasion, we were coming home from the Royal Albert Hall after the British National Brass Band Championships, and we were approached on the tube station platform by a man who was a psychiatrist, and he told George that he used George's music in therapeutic sessions and that he kept using it because it had some effect, it did work. And similarly, 20 years after that, in the, well, only about 2010, something like that, I was at the Royal Northern College for the Festival of Brass, and a man had waited patiently to talk to me at the end of the performance. I was giving a presentation after the performance, and he came and spoke, and he told me that he used the music for therapy. He had a young woman, a patient, who'd had some serious trauma. He didn't say what it was, but she was completely withdrawn. She didn't speak. She was very depressed, and she wouldn't engage with anybody. And in one of his sessions, he sat her down and said, "Would you listen to this?" And he played one of George's slow movements, and she responded. And at the end of it, she said her first words for some time, and she just said, "Ah, he knows." Now, that's anecdotal, I know, and it may be coincidental, but nevertheless, the psychiatrist was impressed enough with that to come and wait and talk to me about it because he wanted me to know about it. And then on a third occasion, after a performance of the Requiem Mass, a young woman came up to me to say that George's music had saved her life. As a student, she'd been extremely depressed with very bad thoughts, dark thoughts, and again withdrawn and not wanting to engage with life. And her father had bought her a CD of one of George's symphonies and said, "Here, listen to this, because when you listen to it, you'll see what this man has done and how he came back from severe trauma and physical injury and mental angst and had great success." And she listened to it, and it said it did indeed turn her life around. It gave her some hope, and she was able to start again. And again, it was important enough for her to come and tell me about it. So I think there is some truth in this, although, you know, it's not, there's no no studies to prove that it's true, although there's a lot of good information now about how music and arts in general are very important parts of our well-being. So I think there is something in it.
And George's life seems to be very much an example to hold up to others alongside the music. It's not just about the music.
That's right, it's not. I think you can lose yourself in the music, and because of the tunes and the harmonies, you can get carried away. You can forget yourself for a while. But I think it's also the example. He came back from complete disaster and trauma. He'd been like on a roller coaster ride. He'd had enormous success, and then he was laid up in hospital with no hope of recovery. And with Nancy's help, it took him a long time, but he was able to come round, and he was conducting great orchestras, selling thousands of CDs and appearing at concerts all over the world. So it proves that it can be done. However serious your trauma, there are ways back.
Thanks, William. We're going to end now by hearing some more music, the rousing final bars of the Fourth Symphony, which seem to point not only to the historical victory of the Second World War, but to George's personal victory as a man fighting for his life and also his own creative vision. Our listeners may also wish to find more of George's music, and if they wish to, then they can go to the website www.georgeloyd.com, where there is a playlist. And also, there is now a specially commissioned playlist, Serene and Mindful, which is available on the George Lloyd Society YouTube channel. Would you recommend these playlists, William?
Well, I certainly would, because I've been involved in putting them together. This first playlist, it's called Serene and Mindful, and the idea is it's 50 minutes of slow movements with a slow-moving backdrop of beautiful photographs of the English Lake District. And Serene and Mindful is what it is, so I certainly would recommend it.
Thanks, William, for your wonderful contribution today, and perhaps you'll come and visit us again sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Peter. I've enjoyed it, and I look forward to another one. Thank you.